everybody. My name's Beverly. I'm an alcoholic. And I know I'm at home in a room full of alcoholics. And I'm glad to be here. It's been several years since I came out. I was looking at the paper over there for the CDs, and it was like 2012. That was a long time ago for me. So once again, I got a little bit turned around in Charlottesville, but I'm all right. I'm from a little country town, a little small town, down in Appomattox, and we just had our anniversary of the Civil War thing, and I got to thinking that I have two things in common with General Lee and the Confederate Army. We both surrendered in Appomattox. Lee surrendered to the Union Army, of course, and I surrendered to the disease of alcohol. So I'm glad to be here tonight. I'd like to start out by giving you just a little bit of a history about me. My father was an alcoholic. I come from an alcoholic home. I can say he was an alcoholic because at one time he came into the rooms of recovery and admitted to a room full of people that he was an alcoholic, and he even stood at a podium and talked, but he didn't stick around. Those of you who don't know, my daddy did pass from cancer about 5-6 years ago, and I stayed sober through all of that. And I watched him drink himself completely away from here, and it was that that the cancer came from, because cancer wasn't something that runs in the family. So I grew up in a dysfunctional home. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of emotional abuse. There was a lot of stuff going on. And we were kind of a poor family, and so I got hand-me-down clothes, and when I started school, I was picked on at school. I was picked on at home, and so it was pretty normal thing for me to find Daddy's liquor cabinet and have my first drink when I was 9 years old. And when I took the drink, I'm going to take this jacket off. If y'all just excuse me a minute. Self-centeredness run riot for me coming down 29. Along about Ruckersville, somebody wanted to have a race with me. And so my self-centeredness, and I'm step on it and throw my Burger King stuff aside when I did. I got a good stain right here. But I came off of that light just like that, and I'm like eating my dust, and then I'm like, I hope that's not somebody going to that AA meeting. So I'm just a little country girl. Progress, not perfection. I'll eventually get things, get where I'm supposed to be. But anyway, took my first drink when I was 9 years old. Now, I do not remember my first candy bar. I do not remember my first meal at Top Treat or Maud's or any of those little country places. And I don't remember any of that. I don't remember my first Coca-Cola. But I do remember my first drink of liquor. Daddy had a liquor cabinet. And I went in the liquor cabinet in the kitchen one day and had me a little sip out of it. And it was good. And, you know, it settled right on down in me. And I felt like I was okay with myself. I felt like I was okay with the family. And I felt like I was okay with the world. And everything was just going to be just fine. And I chased that feeling. So it wasn't very long. I should have known I was an alcoholic from the start, because I already started slipping a little water in them liquor bottles so Daddy couldn't tell that I'd been in his stuff drinking. But he did. And when Daddy found out that he had a young budding alcoholic, he started hauling me around to all the beer joints and stuff. And at that time, he could sneak me into the beer joints, and everything was just fine. If the cops were coming, he'd take Beverly go wait in the car, you know, and things like that. So I became Daddy's little shadow. We drank to like, you know. Excuse me. We drank to like. We went everywhere like. We rode around together. I was his little drinking buddy. And I even followed him into the rooms of AA. And I'll tell you, I came in, my very first meeting was March of 1983. Down at the Appomattox group, me and Daddy went in together. But I decided I didn't have a problem. I was too young. Excuse me. Everybody in there was in various stages of decay. You know, they were grandmas and grandpas. I couldn't relate to that. I was 15, 16 years old. You know, this was no place for me. So I went back out and continued on my path of drinking. But like I said, Daddy was in there for 2 years, and then he went back up. But what I want to say is my sobriety date is October 19th of 2004. Now, the importance of all of this is to tell you that's a lot of drunks and a lot of relapses. if my sobriety date is in 04 and I came in 83. So that's a lot of relapses. And I say that because what I like to talk about along in my story is all the mistakes I made. AA was kind of founded on mistakes. And, you know, it was talking about on failures instead of on successes. And so I like to share about some of my mistakes. Maybe some others won't have to make those same mistakes. So anyway, my first drunk was when I was 16 years old. And at that time, I didn't know what a drunk was. And me and my sister had gone out and riding around and having a good time. And they were drinking fuzzy screwdrivers. I was drinking one, too. I finished mine. And then they were going to pour theirs out. And I said, oh, gosh, no, don't pour it out. Give it to me. So I drank theirs, too. And they were in big 16-ounce cups. And that's when I experienced my first drunk. Didn't know it was happening to me. I was, my speech was slurred, and I was staggering around. And I said to my sister, something's wrong with me. Oh, my God. And she said, Beverly, you're drunk. And that was the first indication of what it was to be a drunk. But I liked it. And I kept on chasing that. What makes me an alcoholic as opposed to a heavy drinker, a moderate drinker, a light drinker, any of the rest of this stuff, is described in the big book as a phenomenon of craving in the Dr. Bob story. Dr. Bob story, whatever it is in the beginning. That's where it describes the phenomenon of craving. See, when I took my first one, I can't stop. I have to have another one. I have to have another one. If I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. So that was me in the early days as well as on throughout my drinking career. And my mother was a non-alcoholic, and that if she took, she said she could drink a half a can of beer. If she drank any more, it was all coming back up. And I couldn't understand somebody like that. It was just getting good for me. I started out as a liquor drinker, but when I finished up, I was a beer drinker. I started at the top of the shelf, kept working my way on down until I ended up finally with drinking beer only. I could get a whole lot of beer. I went through, graduated high school, and the first thing I did, now, when I was going through school, the drinking age was 18, and I could not wait. When I turned 18, the drinking age went to 21. And I was upset about it. But I graduated from high school, and I went out, and my way was to go out and get drunk and party. Then I went on to art school. I didn't really want to apply myself to a college anywhere because I couldn't drink. And the big book is a story in the windows of opportunity. It's in the back. It's one of the fun stories to read. It talks about we trade our drinking in our drinking careers. A non-alcoholic would trade their drinking careers in for a regular career or life or family, but an alcoholic will trade everything else in for the drink, and that's where I was. It did not matter as long as I could get my drink going on. So anyway, I finally did go to art school, and then I went to LPN school. I nearly lost my LPN license when I became a nurse because of my drinking, and I would leave my job and go down to... Instead of going to get something to eat, I had half an hour for lunch, and I would leave and go to the liquor store and get something to drink and just forget about the lunch and then come on back to work. I remember as I was coming along and tried to keep a drinking history pretty short because we all got good drinking histories, but I really like to spend a lot of my time in recovery. But when I was in a coming up through school, my sister, she was promiscuous. She would jump out the window and she'd go out and run around with her men and everything. I was still a kid, you know. I'd go out the window and I told her I'd tell if she didn't get her older men to bring me back alcohol. They did. They would bring back alcohol for me and I'd keep my little promise and not tell nobody. I can remember stealing it off of the side of the beer truck. It's kind of like a bucket brigade. Me and a little fellow named R.L., he's no longer living. He was short and small, and he would grab it off the side of the beer truck, throw it to me, and I'd throw it down a hill, and we had this light bucket brigade going. And then we'd go down in the bottom and sit around and drink it. I don't know of young, normal kids that do stuff like that. Not through their youth, through their high school, through the college, and they don't live like that. And I thought this life was normal, you know. I can remember for fun, we went and ripped off a car, which I say we only borrowed it because It was from Fisher Auto Parts, and we went up and we borrowed this car, and we used it for the night as a party wagon, and we had our fun, but we parked it back there in the morning, so we only borrowed it rather than, you know, stealing it. So anyway, what normal little kids do stuff like that, you know? And that's where it was. So I came in 83, and like I said, I didn't stick around because it just wasn't for me. I was relating out, comparing myself out, instead of relating to what those people were saying up in the AA meeting. And so anyway, I went back out. 1995, I came back into the rooms again. I was doing a lot of Al-Anon at the time, and I was going to a lot of Al-Anon meetings. And sitting in that room, that little small room, they were in there talking about pouring their husband's drink out and stuff like that. And I said, God, I didn't pour daddy's out. I drank it. And I tell y'all this because, you know, what they told me in that Al-Anon room, after several situations where I spoke like that, they told me I belonged in the room out there. And they were talking about AA. And I told them where I thought they belonged. And I left, and I didn't come back there anymore for a while. But, you know, it was starting to beat me down pretty quick. Can you get me a napkin or something? A paper towel. Thank you. It was starting to beat me down fast. You know, I couldn't understand why it was doing what it was doing to me so fast. And I knew deep down inside of me I had a problem. But I kept saying, no, I don't have a problem. Because I didn't want to believe that deep down that I really was an alcoholic, because that meant I'd never be able to drink again. And drinking was just too much fun. So anyway, I came back in broken down. And the big book, again, I refer to it a lot because it's my story. There's a lot of me in it. Thank you very much. There's a lot of me in that big book. And one place it says there is no middle-of-the-road solution and that we have two choices: to recover or go off to the bitter end, you know, however it went like that. And I had gotten very much depressed. I had to be admitted to an institution because I had attempted to take my life. I had gotten to that end of the rope for me that I just did not know. I could not stand living with it, and I couldn't stand living without it. I was miserable if I wasn't drinking, and I was miserable if I was drinking. So I had attempted to take my life. I wasn't going back to that AA thing, you know. I said, and then I started trying all these other different things. In Chapter 3, a bit more about alcoholism, it talks about all these methods we have tried. And because I wanted to prove to myself that I was not an alcoholic, you know, that I could drink like other people, and that I could not possibly be an alcoholic. So I tried to control drinking thing. I tried going to, there was this Benny Hinn conference down in Florida, and my aunt really strongly encouraged me to fly down there and go to that thing with her. And I did, and I went down there, and they had this, I don't know if y'all familiar with Benny Hinn, had this laying on hands. And it said, come out of thee demons of alcohol, come out of thee demons of anger, in the name of be healed. And I was so much slain in the spirit, okay? I'm down on the floor. And I'm just, hallelujah, this is going to work. This is awesome. And I get up and I says to my aunt, Aunt Dottie Lou, let's celebrate. I said, there's a little bar around the corner. And I said, let's just have a drink. You know, let's celebrate. This is my new life. And we went around and I had a drink, and and that was it. And deep down inside, I was very disappointed that even the God thing didn't work. And I thought, well, God don't care nothing about me. God might care about you people, but he don't care nothing about me. And so I went back down that path of destruction. More institutions, more getting locked up, more problems. And I had a problem keeping my hands to myself, you know, and get angry, you know. And I thought I was Annie Oakley. It was a time me and my sister, she's already a convicted felon. And she's not supposed to be under the wheel of a vehicle. She's not supposed to be in a vehicle with a shotgun. I'm the one with the gun. She's the one with the keys. We go borrow another vehicle. And we decide we're going to go hunting these guinea hens down on the farm. They weren't ours, but they were eating our horse feed and our cattle feed. So she's driving. We're doing donuts and everything. I got the gun or the truck, you know. And, you know, you got to get a little closer, Laura. They're getting away from. And anyway, that didn't go over too well either. The law got us. And there she was a felony. Oh, I looted them on the way home. I run them. Because I told my sisters, because we switched seats. We switched seats. I got in the driver's seat. She got in the passenger seat. I said, that's a state trooper. They don't know no back roads. So I looted them. We went around. I dropped my sister off at the house. I went and parked the vehicle where we borrowed it from, and then I jogged on back over to the house. But I didn't know that state trooper cars have cameras on them and all that kind of stuff. So they already had pictures of everything. So I don't think I would have done anything like that if I hadn't been under the influence of alcohol, which made me feel like I was 10-foot-tall, bulletproof, could do anything I wanted to do, and I could be anybody I wanted to be, including Annie Oakley. So anyway, I still feel bad about that, and I think about the awful things that could have happened. And anyway, I can remember coming home. There's this one little area, and it's heavily populated with people living in an apartment. They push baby strollers up and down this little road all the time. And I had gone to a party over in that neighborhood, and I do not remember getting home, but I drove home drunk. And I remember the next day there was all kind of limbs and stuff hanging out from under my truck. And I had to go to town, and I looked, and I wondered, oh, my God. And then I started looking to see if there was any evidence of where I may have hit somebody. Thank God. God was with me that night when I got home, and there was no repercussions and no damages done, because I know I was all over the road if I had all that stuff where I'd have cleaned out the ditches. Again, in 1998, I returned to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had another relapse. I had gone in and out. Started getting into some chronic pain issues. And I left AA and relapsed again and again and again. I like to talk a little bit about my relapses and how they apply to what I read in the big book, because it's my story there. Picked up my first chip in 95, and I always was doing the 1, 2, 3, get drunk. They told me to change people, places, and things. Well, I was still drinking with my daddy. I was still running around with the family, so I was still drinking. And I came back after a relapse, and a fellow in AA said, well, that also includes your family too, Beverly. And I didn't, you know, I was trying to play by my rules. They have said in AA that, you know, what they're saying how it works, old ideas kneel until we let go, absolutely. I had to ride all my horses. I had to drink all that coming to me. And I had to do it my way as long as I could. But my way didn't work. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous does work. But there were some things they told me that I needed to do in AA that at the time I was not willing to do. They told me to get a sponsor. So I was too afraid to ask anybody to sponsor me, and I was too strong-headed, and I thought I could do it on my own, that I decided to sponsor myself, and me and my sponsor went out and got drunk together. So that's how that one worked. They told me I needed to work the 12 steps. I worked step 1, powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable and miserable, and let me tell y'all all about it. And then I went to number 12. Now let me go tell everybody else how bad my life is. So I had to go get drunk a few more times over that. You know, they back then, the old time, that was some tough AA. I mean, they didn't sugarcoat anything. They didn't water anything down. They just told me like it was. And I come in there, and I cried on the tables week after week after week, and they told me, if you're that miserable, go on back out there and get drunk. And you wasted some mighty valuable AA time sitting up in this meeting. Wasting some mighty valuable drinking time sitting up in this AA meeting. They told me things like that because I was not happy. I was restless, irritable, and discontent all the time. and I did not know how to get happy, joyous, and free. It was only until I got into the steps, when I got to the end of myself, I hit another bottom, yet one more bottom, in October of 18 of 2004. And I went up to somebody in AA, and I said, I'm not asking you to be my friend. I'm not asking you to be my buddy. Just walk me through these 12 steps, and then you can forget I ever existed. Because, you know, I didn't have any self-esteem, and I didn't think, who want to be my friend? So anyway, I told her like that, you know, because by then I was desperate. And so I got into the 12 steps with her. I had attempted to start working some of the steps with another sponsor who passed away, Cindy S. And that was a good reason for me to go get drunk. They told me behind every fourth is a fifth. And I was so afraid of that fourth step that I would end up going out and getting drunk again just so I wouldn't have to do a fourth. I'd have to start back at one, two, and three. So that was another way of the drunk waltz for me, where the one, two, three get drunk. Fear was a big factor, and I had no idea I had any fear in me. And I was a self-sufficient, self-made woman, and I know I've told you some of y'all that before, where I came up the hard way. I know how to change some oil. I've done roofing. I've been up on roof laying shingles. I've been doing plumbing. I've worked on a dairy farm. I've even go so far as, you know, me being a little country girl, I go out and get my deer out of the field, bring it in, and put it on the table. I could do the whole process. Same thing with fishing. Loved hunting fish. And I could carry it, could catch it, kill it, whatever, blah, 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 and have it cooked on the table by tomorrow. Squirrels to rabbits, same thing. And so that's what kind of made it really hard for me in AA. Was when I got here, I thought, I can do this. And I didn't think I needed to go to all this extra work y'all were talking about to do it. I managed to stay sober on 2 meetings a week for 3 years. But it was only for 3 years. Because at the time, I was walking to all my meetings, the 2 local ones in Appomattox. And then I started catching rides to some in Lynchburg. But But it was the life-changing experience for me was actually working the steps. It wasn't by Oasis. When I thought for years, I'd just come in, sit in a meeting for an hour, and this stuff was just going to rub off on me, and I was just going to be all right. It did not work for me that way. It was later that I learned that this is my instruction hour, and I take what I'm learning in here, and where it really matters is where the rubber meets the road when I get out there on the pavement. Because that's where life experiences it is. That's where the life experiences have been for me. It hadn't been sitting up in the meetings, smiling friendly with everybody. It's been our genre, where people want to race you. People want to start fights with you. People want to flip you the foot bird. People want to be ugly to you in the store. Things like that. You got family situations that still go on. And I'm practicing trying to learn this new way of life. My only coping mechanism had been with alcohol. That was my coping mechanism. And it was only after I came into the rooms and started practicing in principle, started learning this stuff, which I couldn't learn it on my own. I couldn't understand the book on my own. I had to have some help to understand things. And it was only by getting into this thing and working with the sponsor and going through the first 164 pages and then going into the 12 and 12. It was only by learning these principles in here that I was able to start learning how to cope with life a little bit different on the outside. I know one of my relapses, I was feeling a lot of self-pity, feeling real sorry for myself. I was in a lot of physical pain. I was having a lot of health issues. And I ended up having a slip over that one. I had one where I was angry, full of resentments, full of anger at the things that happened to me as a child, things that happened at the hands of my parents, and things that happened from relatives and next-door neighbors that ain't supposed to happen to no little girls. And so I was eat up with rage. I mean, I was ready to fight at the drop of a hat. Had to learn how to fight to survive. And so I carried all that stuff with me. And it was only through the step work that I was able to turn some of that stuff loose. It was only through that fourth step that I was able to turn some of that stuff loose. Yeah, there's a lot of things that happened to me that weren't my fault at all. But I had to learn how to not carry these resentments on any farther. I had to turn some of the stuff loose. And the promises in pages 83 and 84, one of the promises that says, we will not regret the past, and I wish to shut the door on it. Well, I wanted to forget about the past. I drank a lot because I didn't like feeling all the guilt and the shame that I was feeling, the remorse, the stuff that I did that I wish I could forget, that I wish that I could have been in a blackout when it happened. Some very, very, very hard things today for me to think about sometimes and wonder how I could have been so callous and cold. And it still, you know, bothers me just a little bit. But I don't carry that same guilt and shame anymore. I can look at stuff face on and take a look at it and see where I came from. I've made restitution for a lot of the past. The things that we've done. I could never go back and pay Anheuser-Busch for all that beer we stole off the side of the truck or any of the rest of the stuff I wrecked and ruined in Appomattox County. But I started doing things like when I got to AA, I was giving newcomers rides to meetings. I was buying people the big books and stuff like that. The fella didn't have no money and he had bills to pay. Then AA, I had him come over and mow the grass. And I said, I could pay anybody, but let me get to, you know, it's an AA fellow needs money. I'll get him come over and mow the grass. And whatever I could do. And it wasn't just things in AA. It was things out there, too. And, you know, catching a buggy for a lady that pouring down rain. She loaded her groceries, and I took her buggy back. Just little small things like that. But it's me trying to make restitution and make my amends for the wreckage that I did in the past, and I will always be forever making amends. One of those things was to my AA group. I've opened doors, and I've been to GSR, been an intergroup rep, made coffee for years and years. Started there a long time ago washing ashtrays, but we don't have those anymore. And I wasn't even a smoker back then, but they got me into service work really early on. And so I've done that and gone to the assemblies and, you know, I'm the treasurer now until somebody else wants it. And I'm hoping one day somebody else will. And I guess the longer around AA I am, the more to the back of the room I start trying to be. And I'm trying to get the newcomers and the newer ones to get involved and to start doing things. But I don't want to forget that I also need to set an example for some of these newer ones by continuing to chair meetings, by continuing to do the things that I've been doing. I can remember, I do want to tell you all about my comparing myself out. All those times that I compared myself out, some things really started changing when I started listening and comparing myself in and relating to what some of the other people were saying. I can remember when I was still a babe in recovery, I can remember they were talking about the morning drink. Back then, they just told drunkalog stories. They just sat around with, well, I remember when I did this, and another one was talking about, oh, yeah, you remember those, Peel's beers and Church Keyed opening beers. And anyway, they were talking about taking a morning drink, and I remember saying to them, I said, I didn't take a morning drink. And Jesse said, did you take a drink after 12 midnight? I said, yeah. They said, you took a morning drink. And I was remembering the little liquor bottle stuck up in the, under the mattress when we were talking about that. But for a long time, I was comparing myself out because I didn't want to possibly be one of y'all. And I will, out of regards for the traditions, I won't talk anything about that outside issue stuff that some people snort, sniff, and smoke and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But I tried the maintenance plan, and it didn't work. It didn't work. It nearly killed me. You see, I was still chasing that fix. I was still chasing that I want to feel better. I want to feel normal. I want to feel okay. And I want all my problems to go away. And when drinking quit working for me, I can remember trying that other stuff. And it was like nothing had ever happened. And until I died in an ambulance, I didn't realize what was going on. But we're terrible pharmacists. We don't make good pharmacists. And it was not an intentional thing, but I smoked the stuff and nothing happened. And I smoked some more of it and nothing happened. And I forgot about the fact that I take blood pressure medicine and a couple of other things. One was for tachycardia and stuff, if any of you know what that is, a real rapid heartbeat. And anyway, so I overdid things, and I died in an ambulance on the way to the hospital 3 times. So when I say jails, institutions, is death, I've been privileged to visit all 3, and thank God I'm still here today. I guess God had a better plan in mind. And that'd be the last time, and I share that because there is some other people sitting around that have probably, you know, tried this outside issue stuff, and I just want to tell you where it would happen to me. And so anyway, today I deal with life on life's terms. Not every day is happy and fun to be living around. There's still problems at work. There's still issues at home. But today I try to live in a solution. Instead of living in a problem, I'm more trying to live in a solution. And I find myself doing that, like when me and Mother will be having a conversation. And I'll say, but the good news is, or, well, why don't you try this? Or why don't you try that? And I find my boss will come to me, and she'll be in a big dilemma about something. And I'm like, well, why don't you try this? Or have you given any thought to trying that? You know, different situations, work-related. And so I find myself constantly living in the solutions now. And if I do have a problem, I go to the sponsor. I'll see my sponsor about it, or I'll talk to somebody in the meeting or after the meeting or whatever else like that. I'm still not beyond having a situation, and it keeps me humble that if I am having a situation, that I can still come in an AA meeting and say, look, I've got something affecting my sobriety. I've seen so many that put in double-digit sobriety, 10, 15, 20 years, that are beyond the point of being able to say they got an issue going on in life. And I've also seen those same ones go back out or not come back to AA. And I don't want to be one of those. Humility is being able to make mistakes and come in here and admit them to you. Humility is being able. A couple of years ago, I was just having a really bad day. I was really frustrated. I was having a problem with the gas pump, and I kicked the thing. And a fella came across the island. We had just been in a meeting. And I threw the handle on the ground. I was just really, I was at depression at a point. And he said, Beverly, you just left an AA meeting. You know, where we were talking about serenity or something. And I'm like, oh, God. I was so embarrassed. And I talked to him. His name was Robert. And I said, well, you just don't know. You know. And here I am, most of the time I'm happy, joyous, and free most of the time. But I still have my moments. You know, I have a big old blast of an argument at home and another one here and there. And it just starts building, and I'm trying to be nice around Mother. I mean, nice in this situation. And it it was a straw broke a camel's back. It's the little things. It's never the big deals in life. It's in little things. But I didn't feel like taking a drink over. I just took my frustration out on the gas pump. That's all. So it is important that I try to keep a little bit of humility about me. So how do I check my sobriety? I think about this. I think about a yardstick, and on this end, it's restless, irritable, and discontent. And that's the way it was. My entire waking moment to the time I went to bed was like that. And then on this end of the yardstick is happy, joyous, and free. When I can have serenity in the face of calamity, when bad things can be happening around me and I'm still contented, that's real sobriety to me. That's real emotional sobriety to me. And there are times when I can feel myself having a little bit of a dry drunk spell when I start slipping back into my old ways of thinking. My old character defects start coming out. See, for me, it talks about in the big book about the maintenance of my spiritual condition. What I have is a daily reprieve. And to me, I see that for me is I can't live off of yesterday's sobriety, last week's meetings, last month, so all the wonderful things that I did in AA over the last so many years. Because I'm only one drink away from a drunk. That it would only be one moment, the glass in hand. And then I say, oh my God, how'd this happen again? I've seen it happen so many times to people. And I don't want that to happen to me. So I have to do 1, 2, and 3 in the morning, 10, 11, 12 when I go to bed. I have to check my spiritual condition. How fit is my spiritual condition? I know it wasn't long. This has happened in sobriety. There was one time a man got up, assaulted me in a meeting, threw hot tea on me when I was still on the walker. Threw hot tea on me. Then he body slammed me, tried to knock me to the ground, and then he charged off at the door. And another fellow out there said, you were in a good fit spiritual condition that day, Beverly. And then a year or two later, some guy got mad because we ran out of coffee in the middle of the meeting, and he charged me, and he cussed me, and he spat on me because he wanted some coffee. And it was 8:30 when we stopped to make him coffee. You know, the meeting was 8 to 9. Well, my old character defects came out, and I sort of rearranged his face. And cop came to my door, knocked at night, and I came to the door. I was in a nightgown, and he said, is Mr. Carter around? I said, there's no Mr. Carter. I'm Miss Carter. I seen he had a paper in his hand. And this was in sobriety. I done decked this big guy. I done tore up this man. And here's this officer thinking that it must be another man or something. And a lady comes to the door in a pink nightgown and bedroom shoes. So anyway, I had to laugh about it. Me and Bob are both laughing about it. But it had to do with my spiritual condition. I stopped and I had to think about that. Now, why did I not react when this one man did all this to me? And I was the one down at the law office pressing charges to the magistrate. Yet, I would go off at some man cussing me and spat on me. You know, I'm a barroom girl. I always have been. But, you know, it had to do with my spiritual maintenance of my condition, of my spiritual condition. And I was definitely not in the sunlight of the Spirit then. And because that is something I do have to pay attention to. And, you know, sometimes I might show up at a meeting and I might not be in the sunlight of the Spirit, and I will not share. And I will say I pass. Because if it's something bothering me or something that I'm feeling a little bit of anger towards, I'm probably not in the sunlight of the Spirit, and I'm not going to be able to hear my higher power's voice, much less share anything. See, I learned a long time ago, we carry a message, not deliver a message. Preachers deliver messages, but we carry a message of experience, strength, and hope, coming from our own experiences of our own brokenness to help others that are broken to be able to find a way to heal. And I found hope in these rooms. I found higher power in these rooms. There was not that higher power that was just going to call me up off the floor and say that I was healed. But I found higher power that loved me and cared about me. My sponsor said, if you don't have ones you want, believe in my God. I believe in my higher power. You can borrow mine. And I did that. Somebody who was forgiven, who was loving, and that sort of stuff. That it did not matter how many mistakes I made, they still loved me. And I never, you know, I never had that. See, in life, I'm no different than a lot of people in that the people around you when you're tiny, you know, people around you are your God, especially mom and dad. Well, if you've always heard, I won't love you unless you do this. If you don't get good grades in school, if you don't this, if you don't that. Love was conditional, based on conditions, even significant others in my life. It's always been based on certain conditions. And that's what makes it so hard for me to understand my higher power, is that my higher power loves me unconditionally. It doesn't matter if I mess up. It doesn't matter if I go out and get drunk. It doesn't matter. My higher power is going to love me. It does not matter. And I'm coming to see that. I'm coming to see that as unlovable as I have been in life, and some of the decisions that I've made in life, my higher power didn't stop loving me. I learned that along with my higher power, it's about choices. I can choose to let you people help me. But UAA is not going to make me do anything. But I can choose to follow you. My higher power is sitting back waiting to help me. If I would just say, higher power, please help me. But my higher power isn't going to make me do anything. And in the very beginning, a group of drunks. AA was my G-O-D, group of drunks. Because I needed somebody, a higher power, something greater than myself, that would listen to me. Because my prayers were like praying to the wall. But if I talked to you people, it was like praying to you. And good orderly direction, I would take your suggestions and start doing those things that you told me to do. Gradually, I was able to do that with my sponsor. Start trusting my sponsor, having faith in my sponsor, believing in my sponsor, and following these directions. And then I was able to transfer those feelings to this higher power, which is like the wind. I can't touch or see, not all the time, but I can sure feel it. And I feel like I've got the higher power with me. I feel like the higher power is strengthening me. One other thing I want to tell you all about is this thing I thought was so stupid for years and years. It was, don't quit before the miracle happens. Well, sometimes I wanted instant sobriety. I wanted instant relief. It's like instant potatoes or microwavable TV dinners and all the rest of this stuff. I wanted it overnight. I wasn't expecting it to happen so slowly. The miracle has been happening for me even when I didn't see it. The miracle has been taking years and years and years. Not just from the time I put the plug in the jug. I know lots of people, including myself, that put the plug in the jug and was the same old person. They say the same man will drink again. And I was there to prove it. That, you know, and they said you can sober up a horse thief, but you still got a horse thief. And I was the person to prove it. I was that horse thief coming to meetings and stuff and act like all that and going back out there. And the next thing you know, my name's in the newspaper. You know, that's embarrassing. And having to have to come back up in here after I'd been a group treasurer and secretary and all this kind of stuff. And then I had to come in a meeting and I had a paper that needed to be signed for 5 years probation. I was a very expensive drunk that time. And that was very humiliating. I had to come up before my peers. Many of them had less sobriety than I did, and I was getting a piece of paper signed after all those years in AA. That was a relapse. I can't remember which one it was, but that really doesn't matter, except that kind of thing happened. I hope that I don't ever lose sight of this thing. I hope that I don't lose my enthusiasm for AA. I think this was a 2.5-hour drive, but I don't say no to AA. And I don't ever want to lose my enthusiasm like so many people that say, well, I guess I gotta go to that damned old meeting again tonight. I gotta open that damn door tonight and I'd rather stay home. I hope I don't get to that point. I want this thing to still be alive in me. I want that. Oh, the enthusiasm. I want that enthusiasm to be there. I want this passion for this thing to always be there in me. This is where I feel closest to my higher power. And, you know, I wouldn't be where I'm at today if it wasn't for you people and the God of my understanding and the program known as Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad I finally did surrender and give up and say, I can't do this on my own. You know, and I tell you, at one time, there was times that I came in just looking for friendship, for people to hang out with, or this to do with that. And then when I got completely broken, of myself. I came in, I said, I'm not looking to come in to get friends. I'm not looking to come in here to find a romance. I'm not coming in here looking for this, that, and the other. All I want is to get sober. Because there's nothing better than the joy of being able to be happy, joyous, and free. My sponsor made me look everything up in the Webster's Dictionary. She said, Beverly, look up the word happy. I looked it up. And one of the definitions of happy is contented. Contentment. And that is when I can be contented in all things. When I could be just contented with my infirmities. I have gone through a mini stroke. I went through being in a wheelchair. I went through being on a walker and into a cane. I had a hospital bed. I had somebody coming in there taking care of me and washing my hair and all that kind of stuff and everything. I was not expected to live. The miracle, for me, it has taken time. Like I said, not just the sobriety part, but for life for me, for life, that I am able to live. I am able to continue living. It was almost done for to the point I signed everything over in Mother's name back several years ago. Here I am standing at a podium today, or standing up on these 2 feet without the use of a walker, helping carry stuff in and set up chairs, something I love to do. I took life so for granted before I got sick. I've gotten regained health, not with the help of any of the doctors. Doctors gave me no hope. This has been nothing but a miracle of God. This past summer, my old boss came up to me and said, would you like to come back to work for us? And I said, yes. Now, these are things that I only heard when I went to speaker meetings up at the big conferences. I would hear these speakers stand up there talking about things that were given back to them in sobriety. And that's the first time I got up and walked out the room. Like, yeah. You know, because I didn't think it would ever happen to me. And true, there's nothing, material things mean nothing to me. It's just having that peace of mind, that I don't have to have. It's not about, well, I got this big job back, or I got this big job, and I got this big family, and it's nice home, and it's nice picket fence, and dogs, and 2 cars, whatever. None of that's happened. Lost daddy and everything back 5-6 years ago. Mom's not getting any younger. Going through a lot of different situations, but it's not about material stuff anymore. Today it's about peace of mind. It's about peace. These are things that I would not have gotten through my nursing or taking Psych 101 up there to college or any of the rest of that stuff. This stuff comes from AA. All of it. From me being a shy little girl, coming up to having the confidence to be able to look people in the eye, be able to talk from a podium, not having to have something to drink to get here, not having to have something to drink to get at the podium, and all that kind of stuff. I was a very shy little person long time ago where I only hid behind books. And my answers were yes, no, and to where I am today. This has all happened because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It, you know, there's only one step in Alcoholics Anonymous that anything to do with the drinking, and that's the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's a manifold. 2 through 12 is about learning how to live with myself and live on life on life's terms, being reasonably happy in this world and hopefully be reasonably happy in the next. I mean, that's where it's all at to me. And I didn't want to spend my time just going through all the steps like so many people do. Because you get a lot of that. I like to come at it from a different perspective and just tell what has happened to me as a result of trying to do, you know, the steps, the traditions, do life the way things were supposed to be done, you know, like the way I was taught in Sunday school way back then, and the golden rule and all that. I find myself living that way today. I practiced it in the beginning. I learned it in the beginning. I live it today. So it's not so hard doing the steps. I worked them one time. And the more practice I gave to these steps and these principles, now it becomes second nature. And I'll tell you this. I was at a one of these AA conventions we were all, everything was breaking up. And there was a group of people in the hospitality room. And they were one of them said to the other ones that were sitting there, who all wants to help with this, carry this stuff out to the truck, carry it back to the intergroup office? I went, I help. And then I said, where's your intergroup? And before I even realized what I did, I said, I help. I didn't know where the intergroup was. This wasn't even my city. This wasn't even my town. I mean, this was somewhere down in Hopewell, or maybe it had been Virginia Beach or something. And I catch myself doing that. I use that as an example, but I catch myself doing that all the time. I do things without thinking, and it used to be my things that I did without thinking were all bad things and stuff that I had to make amends for later. Now, a lot of the things I do without thinking these days are kind things, good things, compassionate things, things that I read about in the big book, letter from front cover to back cover. Part of a changed life is not so much as what comes out of this right here, but it's what comes out of my actions. So anyway, y'all have been an awesome audience tonight. I haven't heard a phone go off. I haven't seen anybody sitting in here texting or taking a nap. I'm like, wow, y'all are awesome. But anyway, I thank y'all, and I owe everything about my life, everything that has happened and here and forward. I went to the God of my understanding, you people, in this program known as Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope to continue to trudge with you on this road to happy destiny. Thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you.